And a couple things that were dawning on me, right? The fact that this is now episode 12, right? And 12 is pretty significant in terms of cycles and the ending of cycles. So yeah, if you don't know or if you've never heard, right, I would recommend Googling 12 and then the words angel number. And then I want you to click on the Sacred Scribes link. And that one will give you a pretty good run through. Also, if you ever want to like just check out your angel numbers, or if you like see numbers throughout the day and you're like, oh my gosh, why do I keep seeing these numbers? Like, what does it mean? Check out Sacred Scribes, head to them, and you might get some insight that you might find really helpful. But generally speaking, right, 12 functions not only as a signifier, right, of this sort of ending of cycles, hint, hint, 12 months in a year, well, I won't get into all of the hints, but specifically, right, 12 is a number and it can act as a sign or a message that you should not be hindered by old habits that need to be changed, right? So it tells you to look to new experiences with optimism as they will bring about favorable and positive effects and opportunities. So this helps with achieving goals and aspirations and allows for the old to be replaced with the new. I also find it interesting because 12, right, is the inverse of 2-1, right, of 21. There are 21 major arcana cards in a tarot deck. And so I think it's just interesting how there is sort of kind of even that link to the tarot, right? And maybe I'm kind of just rambling now and going off the cuff, but what I'm understanding through this messaging, through the number 12, and just through this moment in my life through tarot, is that I've learned, right, a pretty significant amount of lessons, but there are still more than half. I'm not even halfway, right? I have a lot more to go in terms of what I need to learn, how I can improve, how I can change, right? This comes from me expanding my knowledge, in just learning more, reading more, engaging more, right? But it also comes down to how I communicate this knowledge, right? How I connect this knowledge with other individuals. And that's why I'm introducing a pretty significant change to the structure of the podcast moving forward. And if you couldn't already tell, this is a somewhat inadvertent season finale of season one, I guess you could say, as we transition now into this new season. I also wanted to do this transition or this kind of like wrap up finale kind of moment because of the new theme song. That's right. I have been working tirelessly with amazing, when I say amazing, like y'all, the talent of this individual is otherworldly. I just don't think that I have never come across it on this plane of existence other than in this person, and I am just absolutely dumbfounded. Anyway, the person I'm talking about is Kamau, also known as Kamau Mimbonisi Kawame Aguiman. Oh, wow. Sorry if I butchered your last name. That was really not appropriate of me. A little bit of history for y'all, right? A little bit of culture, a little bit of context. Kamau is a male name of Kenyan origin that may refer to, or it's essentially sort of the primarily, like this masculine name in the Kikuyu, I think is how you say it. It's essentially just belonging to the Bantu group who migrated from the Congo region. Originally, right, the name Kamau was given to a group of young men who went through initiation together, and the group was actually called Arika. But I should make note, right, that this practice, this sort of tradition, is no longer in place, right? And so this it's kind of shifted and changed. So Kamau, right, this sort of functions as kind of like an honorific or a sort of tie to the ancestors. And so now the name is actually passed on through the naming system in a family from the ancestor who received the name through the initiation process to the next generation, right? And so as a result, it is now used as like a sort of birth/given name inherited from a relative. And for many individuals, actually, it's sort of become now their family name. And that's a brief history lesson, but anyway, you should definitely go and support Kamau. They have a couple different sort of stage names. Their most famous is Kamau, which is K-A-M-U-U. They've also gone by Brother Kamau in the past. I would start off with his EP, which is called the Kamau Cassette, Mixed Greens. Came out back in July of 2019. Absolutely amazing. This individual's vocals is just wow, 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 wow. And he's actually the individual who you hear performing that sort of like ethereal sort of intro music that I was using on the earlier episodes during season one. But now that we're going to be starting season two, kicking season two off with a bang, you best believe that y'all going to be hearing his voice both at the start, on the kickoff of the new Zabuma Foolish intro, as well as the outro music. So I'm going to play actually a little snippet, just a little clip of the new theme song. And it's actually going to be fully featured on the first episode of season two. Yes, or episode 13. I haven't really decided the naming system yet. I think I kind of want to keep the numbers going. Like the episode will still be number 13, but I'll just call it season two, if that makes sense. So that there's a little bit more of that distinction, that sort of break in the gap. And yeah, another reason why we're doing this little bit of a distinction, this break in the gap, the little change, rearrange situation for season two, is because I found that I wasn't feeling bad by asking y'all to subscribe to my Patreon, because I do put a lot of work into there. And I actually prepare a lot of content for y'all that is rather specific, and I do hope that, you know, the individuals who have subscribed to the Patreon value that sort of work that I'm doing. However, I've recognized that their Patreon is a pretty unique opportunity for me to sort of redistribute that wealth and also really establish a sense of community, not only with fellow queer individuals, but with fellow Black queer individuals, specifically in the field of academia. And so a new segment that I'm going to be introducing for season two is Ask an Academic. Yeah, your boy is going to be doing live interviews, and they are going to be hosted by me, and I'll be interviewing an individual who is either identifies as Black or Indigenous, and hopefully also queer, but that might not always be the case. And we're going to be doing it once a month. So once every four episodes, you'll get an Ask an Academic feature. And essentially what that's just going to look like is going to be sort of an interview style format where I have prepared some questions for an academic in a given field. And it's usually going to be tied to whatever it is we're talking about in the three episodes beforehand. So for example, in the coming future, I've sort of planned out like an oceans kind of themed episode series of episodes following this whole Seaspiracy thing. And then at the end of that, we'll do a sort of review and recap and then conversation with an individual scientist who's working in that field, right? In this case, it would probably be marine biology or some sort of ocean conservation sciences. And then I'm going to be using my Patreon funds to pay them. Yes. So if you are listening to this now and you're like, oh my gosh, I'm Black or Indigenous or Black and Indigenous, and you identify as queer or any or all or some of the above, shoot me an email. Yes, right now. Stop what you're doing and write me an email to jaunting.j@gmail.com. That is jaunting.jay@gmail.com. Or if you have a friend that you know who is Black or Indigenous, or Black and Indigenous and queer, or Black and queer, or Indigenous and queer. Anyway, any combination of them, get them into my inbox, okay? I have money for them to have, and that's sort of my goal, my hope for the Patreon moving forward is, of course, to supplement myself, provide myself with some income, because I don't get paid to do this work, and I do appreciate, you know, any financial support that y'all can provide. Really, really helpful. However, moving forward, right, I want you to know that it's not always going to be solely going to me, and there is going to be, I'm going to make it very clear, especially if you are subscribed to the Patreon, where the money is going to and how much is going to. My hope is to start off with $50 to $100 per guest speaker. But as of right now, I'm only making, like, I'm making just around that through Patreon. So I'm going to try and spend this next couple months or so trying to bump up the Patreon a bit more. But if this sounds like a great idea to you, if you, like, want to support up-and-coming, you know, academics in this space, because this is the thing too with the Ask an Academic section, I'm not going to be spending a lot of time trying to ask industry professionals who are like well way into their field. Like, I'm not trying to get, you know, the opinions of like people who are essentially just like clicking the buttons, doing their tasks, and are not really like engaging with the kind of work that they're doing. Instead, I'm going to be asking mainly young people, people who are still studying, people who maybe just finished their schooling, people who have just started working in their field, right? Because I want to provide y'all with not only more of a nuance perspective, or like a novel perspective, I would say, when it comes to academic individuals, but I also just want it to seem relevant, right, to us. Not to say that, like, if you're older listening to the podcast isn't relevant to you, or not to say that if you're younger listening to this podcast is not relevant to you, but I think that, like, actually listening to individuals, professionals who are 20-something, 30-something, right, existing in this space as professionals, I think is really powerful to not only, like, have a place where we can all sort of meet and discuss and talk, which will be this podcast, The Boom of Foolish, but just the opportunity, right, to sort of showcase your work and talk about your work in a very safe setting that doesn't come with these expectations of, like, you know, you have to be perfect and proper and speak all of the jargon and use all of the terminology. It's like, no, that's not what's happening. This space is just going to be a safe space where we can shoot the shit, we can have casual conversations about what is happening in the world and the work that we're doing. And that's sort of all the announcements I had for y'all in terms of new podcast segments, in terms of new theme songs, in terms of kind of the new updates and where I'm going. That's sort of where I'm at. That's kind of where Jalen is with his Zabuma Foolish. And I hope that this all sounds good to you. And if it doesn't, well, you're listening to the wrong podcast. So yeah, without further ado, I'm gonna play a little bit of the theme song for y'all now, because I said I would like 20 minutes ago and I still haven't shown y'all the sample. All right, y'all ready? Here it is. Just a sample, just a little teaser, okay? And that's it, that's all you get. That little boop, 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 boop. Yeah, I am so excited to start off season two with this killer theme song, y'all. Like, it just gives me such vibes, and I just want to move my body in the most, like, contemporary dancer kind of ways, you know? Like, from So You Think You Can Dance and Dancing with the Stars, those whole, like, you know, when those people, like, would move, and then they'd be, like, on their toes, and then, like, oh, into the side, and then it's, like, oh, my thighs, and then, oh, I'm back on my toes, and I'm whirling around on the ground, like, that kind of dancing. Like, it just makes me feel, oof, all the feelings, all of the motion, all of the vibes, and I cannot wait to play it for y'all in full next episode. But I also realize now, right, that we're 15 minutes into this week's episode, and I haven't given any indication as to what the other segments of the podcast are going to look like, and or what this episode is even all about. So without wasting any more of your time, let's get into this week's Animal of the Week. Yeah, if you thought that this was just like an announcement episode, don't worry. This is a full episode still. You're going to get your Animal of the Week. You're going to get your 626. You're going to get your What's the Sitch, okay? But I just had to spend a little bit of time giving y'all an update about what's happening moving forward and where we're going to be. And without waiting anymore, let's just talk about Animal of the Week. I also realized now that because I always did like a little jingle ingle moment, that I never had a sort of intro tune. Like, I always did something before the theme song. And then it would be the theme song, and then it would be Animal of the Week. And so I'm realizing now, I'm like, oh my gosh, I don't have any sort of jingle for Animal of the Week. To be honest, I think this podcast may have too many jingles. So we're going to clean that up. We're going to clean that up for season two. And it's straight up going to be just the intro and the outro. I may keep What's the Sitch because, you know, I love me a good communicator sound. But as this podcast continues to grow and gain listeners, I don't want Disney to find me or to clock me. So as of right now, that's not an issue, and I expect to keep it that way. But who knows? Who knows how big this could be or how big this could get? I do, actually. This is going to become big. This is going to be the next biggest thing for Canadian media. I tell you what, mark my words, mark the date, mark the premonition on your calendar, because I said it, I'm affirming it, and I'm putting it out into the world. And I'm going to plan on doing a little something. I don't know yet. I'm figuring out if this is going to be a common staple. Maybe I'll just name the episodes this moving forward. But tarot is definitely going to be much more discussed moving forward because, one, I've been practicing it much more, and I just cannot deny its power anymore or, like, the potential for healing that it has. And even if you are not, like, if you're listening to this, you're like, I don't fucks with tarot. What the fuck is that? What is this witchcraft shit? What is this hubba-labba-labba-doo-ba-doo? Do not worry, okay? Do not worry. Take the word tarot out of your mouth if that's what's giving you all of the, you know, the stress and anxiety. And just listen to the words and the messages that you hear from this podcast. And if they resonate with you, bomb. Perfect. Great. If you want to find out where that info is coming from, partially informed by tarot, partially informed by academic research. So, yeah, rambling, fully on it. So today's Animal of the Week, which is also one of the major arcanas, is the Hermit. Yes, typically speaking, when we say hermit in the, like, animal field and world, we're talking about hermit crabs, which I'm going to talk about too specifically after. But I kind of wanted to just talk a little bit more about the Hermit in general and this major arcana card and the sort of energies around it, because this is the card that I kept pulling. I swear, like, the past three readings I've had, I've just keep pulling this card, okay? And so this is this card, which is called the Hermit. It sort of has some key words and phrases associated with it. And so I'm going to read those out to you now. I want you to just take a deep breath and listen to these words and see if they resonate with you, okay? So the first, here goes. A sage or mentor. Wisdom. Listening to guidance. Introspection. Taking time away. Listening to your heart. A time for meditation and contemplation. Finding your voice, a time out, a cautioning against spending too much time alone. This is, I can't believe that I kept pulling this card because for me, right, I'm go, always, every day, literally trying to do the most 100,000 million trillion percent, okay? But this is not sustainable. This, I've learned, right, is it very much leads you to crashing. And if you have ADHD, if you are a fire sign, if you are doing the literal most and you're always trying to do right, you might not have the best ability at recognizing, right, when it is you're going to burn out, right, until it happens. And so what the Hermit does, what the Hermit reminds us, right, is to take these breaks, to take these moments for reflection, for introspection, for meditation and contemplation before we're burnt out, right? It's to be proactive in our rest so that we don't get to the point where we are hermiting ourselves, where we have to enter into a hermit-like state because we are too overwhelmed by the own actions that we're performing, right? And so this is why I love the Hermit card so much, because it is a very visceral and undeniable reminder that, bitch, you need to slow down. Bitch, you need to take a break. Bitch, not every day go, right? And I think that that's super important for not only academics in general, but especially for any individual who's in post-secondary education who isn't a straight white man, right? Because the amount of work that the academia at large puts on you in order to show up as yourself is just, it's dumbfounding, right? The amount of hurdles you have to jump through, the amount of masking and artifice and presentation that you have to work into creating so that you can exist in these academic spaces that are rather restrictive and very exclusionary, right? It's a lot of work. It can be a lot of work, especially for someone like me who is both Black and queer, let alone for individuals who are just queer or just occupying, you know, a racial identity. I think, you know, it can be very challenging. And so this hermit is a message to you, it's a message to me, right, that we can and should be proactive in how we take breaks, okay? And there's also a little bit of like a poem kind of that I want to read about the hermit. So yeah, I'm just going to read that now for you here. It goes, "Oh, sweet light, how it glows. She is ready to see the miracle of luminosity. The soft emanation from the ethers that she senses in her heart. She sees the light in dreams, and she knows that its brilliance comes bundled within light, both sunlight and moonlight. So she journeys alone under the stars, ruminating on where it originates and how to access its wisdom more readily. The hermit reminds you to process your experiences as a way to learn, knowing that your own smile is great company. Listen deeply and see the lessons that live in the simplest of things. The shiny lights you see in others are a reflection of the magic you already hold in your heart. So choose words that fuel your envisioned path and speak with the passion of purpose. It's time to find the stage within." The sage within. Sorry, y'all. And that's it, really. That's it, really. It's about being comfortable with yourself. It's about being okay with rest. It's about being committed, right, to not necessarily being jealous all the time of other people and all their things and all their accoutrements, but actually seeing those things, right, seeing people's success, seeing their trinkets and what have you, and using that, right, to fuel your own motivation, right? Seeing that and then using it as a sort of reflective surface for you to then create and form your own ways, right, of accessing those very same things that you're seeing, right? And so I think that the hermit is a very unique message for all of us. And again, interesting kind of why tying it into Animal of the Week with the hermit crab, right, is because the hermit crab does just that. The hermit crab will just chill, it will wait, it will bide its time, right? All the while, it's growing, right? Inside of this shell that it's had, right, the crab itself is still growing. Right? It's still absorbing nutrients from the outside world. It's still interacting with the world in and of itself, but it's doing so in a much more recluse way, right? In a much more closed off setting. And so this is not to say that when you're taking a moment of rest or when you're closed off in order to reflect, right, and meditate and recuperate, it doesn't mean that you are somehow separated from the world or not a part of the wider community that we all exist within. It just means, right, that your participation in this moment is much more self-guided, right, than as a part of the community. And why, I'm tying it back to hermit crabs, I think that this is so, yeah, interesting, is because if we look at the behavior of hermit crabs, right, this is exactly what they do up to a point. up to a point, because we have to remember, right, that we can't just be hermiting our whole lives. We can't just be reflecting and never go out into the world and then try and put this vision that we've had and crafted of ourselves out into the world, right? So we have to remember that it's not all just about going within, finding time within, spending time alone. You actually have to put yourself at risk. You have to then go out of your shell, right? And step into the world authentically. And this is what hermit crabs do once. I mean, it's pretty infrequent, but it's when it happens, it causes a chain reaction. So essentially what happens is when a hermit crab, right, who has outgrown their shell and they need to find a new home, right, what will happen is they'll all actually aggregate to the sort of same spot on the beach or to a relatively same kind of meeting place. And what will happen is the largest hermit crab, right, the one that's had the most time to sort of grow and meditate and reflect and is now, you know, robust and protected and guarded and is able to jump out of their shell into the outside world, they will leave that shell, right, in order to go and find a larger shell to go place themselves within and then do some more growing, right, some more reflecting. But this is what I find so interesting, is this chain reaction that happens when that largest hermit crab leaves its shell, right? Is it actually allows for smaller hermit crabs to then move up, right? And actually occupy a larger home because you're no longer occupying that space. And I just think that that is so incredibly beautiful and so reflective of our own sort of pathways to self-reflecting and to social isolation and to just self-isolation, because it's once we leave that space, right, once we actually step out into the world or step out into a way of existing that's a little bit more authentic after a time of reflection, right, is that it actually allows for others to step into that space too. And it's like, and it actually signals to others, like, hey, you can do this. You can actually take a moment. You can actually pause. You can actually use your time and your energies to reflect within, right, before stepping out. But what I think it's so extremely reflective in the case of the hermit crabs, right, this sort of reciprocity between resting and moving. But I don't think it's exactly the case, right? It's not like a perfect metaphor. But I do think it's a really beautiful example, and a kind of why I wanted to tie it into this week's Animal of the Week. So if you've never seen a hermit house swap, I will put a video up on the Patreon. So that's patreon.com/jauntingjay. And it'll show you what I mean. It's like a little video that shows literally like a group of hermit crabs all together. And then as soon as the large one leaves, it's like a chain reaction. And then it's like, then the next one goes into that one. And then the next one will go into the one's old one. And then it will go all the way through, right? The shells. But the gag is, and this is actually maybe a message to us as well, right? Is that the last person to leave their shell, right, is the one who has the least amount of opportunities to choose their new home or to choose their new setting, to choose their new environment, right? And so we have to remember, right, that as we ourselves are occupying the sort of hermit status, right, we can't get too complacent, we can't get too comfortable, right, in this protected sort of position that we are now in, all right, as the hermit. And we have to remember, right, that we actually have to leave this at some point, right? Because if we spend too much time in this state, in this reflective, closed-off world, right, that we've created for ourselves in order to grow, we actually won't be able to grow, right? Because we actually will miss out on opportunities to connect with others, to expand ourselves, to expand our learning, right, if we stay only within. And that's that got really meta, that got very philosophical, a little spiritual. And you know what? I low-key liked it. So I'm going to now jump into experiment 626 before moving into what's the sitch. For this week's experiment 626, the paper title is Extraordinary Numbers of Giant Squid, Archaeotithis dux, which is apparently the Latin name. Again, don't come for me. And it continues, encountered in Japanese coastal waters of the Sea of Japan from January 2014 to March 2015. Essentially, this paper is just a giant red flag to tell the world that there are not only a lot of giant squids, but they are in the places that we see them the most. It's not even where they live. Yeah. Okay. So I'm not going to get, I won't spoil it too much, but let's kind of break it down by parts, right? So as we remember, scientific papers, they have the sort of typical sections. They have the abstract, they have the intro, they have the materials and methods, they have the results, and then they have the discussion, right? And so I'm going to just quickly talk about each of those sections today. I don't want this week's Experiment 66 to be too long because I feel like we've already kind of been talking a lot during this episode. So we're going to kind of not necessarily rush through this part, but I'm just going to give you the sort of brass tacks because, yeah, y'all need to just get this goodies, and then we're going to move on to what's the sitch. So the abstract reads as following. So in total, 57 giant squid were found between January 2014 and March 2015 in Japanese coastal waters in the Sea of Japan. So occurrences were especially high around Sado Island and in Toyama Bay. All of the squid occurred individually, and 28 of the 57 were found alive. The occurrences were categorized into three groups based on distance from the shore and the depth at which they were found. So the first group was 1, washed ashore on a beach or found floating at the surface close to a beach. So there were 19, right? So of the 57 individuals, 19 of those were dead and just like washed ashore to the beach. Cool, cute. Category number 2 is those caught in a fixed net set in coastal waters between 50 and 150 meters depth. So out of the 57, y'all, that is 28. So 28 individual giant squids were caught, okay, in these sort of fixed nets at depths of 50 to 150 meters below the surface of the water, right? 28 of them they caught this way. Wow, that's alarming, at least to me, to hear that number. I was like, what? Maybe one, but in a year you caught over, that's wild. Okay, anyway, so then number 3, the third category, is those that were caught by bottom trawl or bottom gill net fisheries several kilometers offshore between 200 and 300 meters below the surface. And with this number, actually, with this third grouping, it was their lowest grouping, so the smallest grouping. It was only 10 individuals that they found, okay, in this sort of third grouping. Then the research paper moves into its intro, right, where it kind of just goes into an introduction about giant squids, kind of talks about their history, what you kind of sort of expect by their physiology, their biology, as well as their sort of like historical range, specifically through the coastal waters of Japan. And I'm not going to read through the entire intro because I think it was kind of boring. But the thing that I did think that was rather interesting was the fact that like we've been documenting giant squid sightings since as early as 1857. And we haven't actually like confirmed them. I think the first like confirmation they said didn't happen until 1912. Y'all, that's like, that is absolutely wild to me. And that was like only one confirmation, right? It took them like many more years after. It wasn't until like the 1960s, I think. 1980s that we actually finally started to like follow up on reports of giant squids and actually like see them and categorize them and be like, oh my gosh, okay, it's not just some like myth, it's not like just the Kraken, it's not just Krakatoa, like yes, they are real. And if you don't live in Japan, you might not know this. I mean, I didn't before reading this paper, but apparently historically in Japan, right, giant squids wash upon the shore very occasionally or semi-occasionally, right? And they've actually been seen floating at the surface of coastal waters of the Sea of Japan. And sightings like this have become very common, right? They've actually made local news as early as, I think the earliest that they reported here was 1968. And 1983 and 1993, there's been a couple different sort of news cycles around these giant squids in Japan. Their methods, again, I'm not going to read through the methods and materials because it was low-key kind of boring. So if you do want to repeat it, I will Or if you're just interested in reading a little bit more about that specifically, you can find the article on Patreon, on my Patreon. I'll link it there. But essentially, all you need to know about the methods was that they used like a lot of community networks and like personal contacts in order to sort of get individuals and fisheries to start reporting these instances of whenever like a giant squid or a large squid was discovered or spotted. Then the team would go out, they would confirm it. There would usually be like media there already, so they would know if it was like a confirmation or just like a fake call. And then in order to then like tie these sightings to like some other metric, because usually science, like, you can't just have data stand alone by itself. For whatever reason, people always want you to like justify it by tying it to something else. And so what they did was actually attach these sightings, right, to the mean horizontal water temperature. Right. So, and they did this through like a tri-monthly sort of 10-day mean of the horizontal water temperature, because they were trying to connect both water temperature and depth to the occurrence of these sort of giant squid sightings. The results section is a little bit more interesting than the rest of the paper. It kind of just shows you different maps that actually have all of the different like reportings of the giant squid. And then the way that they've broken it down on the maps is like sort of by category. So if it was reported by an individual versus by a fishery, they have it if it was a confirmed sighting or unconfirmed. They have it if it was alive versus dead. They have it classified also by size. So really good data that they've actually gone out and collected. But if I'm going to be honest, we've reached my favorite part, which is the discussion, right? And the discussion section of any research paper is usually the part that you want to jump to first after reading the abstract, because it'll give you all of sort of the meat, that really nice, as a vegan, should I even be using meat as a metaphorical term? Lol. Anyway, the discussion is where you're going to get the good goods, the juicy juice, the bits and bops that you want to read about, right? The explanations for the data that they're presenting. And so I'm just going to read a little blurb, because they have like all these different possible explanations, but I really liked this one in the discussion. So I'm going to read it for you to you. And this sort of explanation talks about why giant squids have been so frequently found either dead or alive on the beaches or along the sort of coastal waters of the Sea of Japan, right? And so the explanation that they have written here is that at the beginning of winter, right, the surface water is cooling down from the northern peripheries. So along the continental coast, and the cold surface water is what, at 0 to like 1 degrees, and it subsides into a deeper stratum. Oh my gosh, they're using such annoying words. So that colder water gets deeper into the lower layers of the water. I think it's so interesting that we literally add like the most annoying names to things, like the top of the water column. You can't just call it the top. It's the epipelagic. We can't just call the middle of the water column the middle. It's the mesopelagic. And we can't, like, you know, like, we can't just call the bottom of the ocean the bottom. It has to be the benthic. It's just very interesting, all the terms and the jargon and what we'll use when we're trying to communicate to the general public what we found. But this is not a science communication critique. This is just me telling you about giant squids. So essentially it goes on to say that cold water subsistence commences from the north and gradually extends to the south as winter progresses. So this cold water movement actually might reduce the suitable temperature habitat of the giant squid, both horizontally and vertically, right? So they are forced to move southward and to shallower depths. So some individuals would be weakened by exposure to extremely cold waters and then transported by these sort of eddies and like the sort of waves and the movement of the water through the Tsushima current, along through that strong northwesterly sort of seasonal winds, which would result in them coming closer to Japan's coastal waters and explain them being trapped in fixed nets or becoming stranded on beaches along the Japanese coast, right? And I'm even confused, and I just read that out to y'all. So I think from my understanding, essentially what they're saying is the reason why you see so many giant squids, especially along the coast of Japan, is the way that the temperature in the water changes from seasons. And essentially what it's saying that as winter temperatures cool, they actually create uninhabitable environments for these giant squids. So these giant squids are just like, fuck, it's too cold. Like, I literally cannot. And they can't just like throw on a parka because, you know, hashtag tentacles, only, you know, we don't make 9-arm jackets. And so as a result, they're like, oh my God, I'm so fucking cold. And they'll like swim up, or they'll swim south, or they'll swim down. They'll do a bunch of different things. And depending on what they do, they'll either die, get washed ashore, they'll get trapped in a net, or they'll never be seen again. So I think that's a really cool sort of explanation. If you want to find out more about giant squids, about their population size, just about them more generally, I will link some other resources over in the Patreon. So that, again, you can head over to patreon.com/jauntingj. But now let's move into What's the Sitch?
So what's the sitch?
For this week's What's the Sitch, I'm taking it a little bit closer to home because I was trying to do some shopping and some research for my cat. We are getting ready to move to a new part of the city, and I know that there is just going to be some potential exposure to some higher risks, let's just say, if my cat does go outside. Supervise, don't worry. And that being said, I was like, okay, how do I be precautionary? How do I maybe get ahead of the ball? And I was looking into purchasing some flea collars. And then when I was doing some research, apparently there's like all this drama, gagaroni about flea collars in general. And then I came across this story that was like very new. It broke, I think, March 3rd, 2021. So if you're listening to this, it's like maybe a 2-week-old, 3-week-old story. Although I don't know if you're listening to this at some point in the future, sorry, it's the date right now is March 29th, 2021. So 20 days or so. Anyway, the newness of the story isn't relevant, but the data actually is. So the gag is, right? So the very popular flea collars, I think the name of this particular case is Seresto, was actually linked to 1,700, so that's 1,700 deaths, right? And the gag is the Environmental Protection Agency hasn't issued any warnings about these flea and tick collars. And this is such a gag, right? So these flea and tick collars, they've been linked directly to the deaths of 1,700 animals. And despite 75,000 incident reports between 2012 and 2020, the Environmental Protection Agency still hasn't issued any warnings about the collars. So Elanco, the company that sells the collars, actually told a news organization, I believe the news organization that initially broke this story was Insider. Anyway, I have the quote here, and they go, "A report is not an indication of cause." As if, bitch, as if 75,000 people plus 1,700 deaths don't indicate the goddamn cause. What? Yeah, that's a fucking gag, especially when the report itself, like, not only talks about the animals that were injured, like the non-human animals that were injured, but it also talks about, like, the humans that were injured too. Like, there have been over 900 incidents, right, of those 75,000, over 900 incidents involved humans getting hurt. And there is actually a super severe case where a 12-year-old boy was actually hospitalized with seizures and vomiting after sleeping with his collar-wearing dog. Now, I maybe need to take a step back, because if you don't have pets, you've probably never worried about fleas or like thought about them or know much about them. So I'm going to give you like a little bit of an intro into the conflict, because yeah, so I have a cat, and dog fleas, which are very much their own thing and very gruesome and larger and brutal, are not the same thing. Cat fleas are a little bit different, right, in the sense that they are much smaller, and they don't have like the same, I guess, voracity when it comes to like laying eggs and reproducing that other fleas have, like specifically dog fleas. The thing with cat fleas that you really need to know, it's the same actually with all fleas, is that there are what's called obligate hematophages, which essentially just means they have to eat blood in order to live. That's like their food, the thing that gets them through the difficult days, blood. Blood, 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 blood. Spanish, sangre. Anyway, that being said, if a flea doesn't ever eat any blood, it won't be able to reproduce. So for a flea to become sexually mature, it actually needs to feed on blood at least once. What a weird strategy for life. But then again, everyone's trying to be a vampire and or Sookie Stackhouse. So, I mean, I can understand why. Back to the flea drama. So the Environmental Protection Agency, right, they reported that these Seresto collars, they're like, again, if you don't have a pet, if you've never seen one of these collars, you're like, how the fuck does it even work? So I'm going to tell you. They actually take, like, just your standard kind of, like, porous plastic, and then they impregnate it with insecticides, right? So then these insecticides get slowly released over a period of months, and the design is they're supposed to, like, coat the animal's fur, right, with two major insecticides. So the main ones that are used, especially for flea control, are flumethrin, which just, like, repels and kills ticks and fleas. But then there's also another one really popular called Imactaloprid. And that's essentially just like a Anyway, a neonicotinoid is just something that prevents like the life stages from happening. So in the flea's case, it stops the fleas from producing beyond the egg stage. Yeah, so if once the eggs are, like, laid or whatever, it then stops them from developing. So pretty cool chemical. Don't know if I want it on my animal. And by my animal, I mean my friend, cat, Kita. Now, the gag is, right, you normally would get a collar that would have, you know, an insecticide, and then you'd get a different one that would have your neonicotinoid, right? But if what this report is claiming and what a couple scientists have sort of hopped on to sort of confirm is that it's the synergistic effect between the flumethrin insecticide and the imidactyloprid neonicotinoid. Oh, wow, I really can't use English. Anyway, it's the combination of these chemicals that is likely acting as a sort of killer, right? And is really essentially just poisoning anyone that puts this on their animal, as well as poisons the animal itself. And the gag is, right, this is all just to control both, it's the use of these collars, right, is to control a form of conflict between wildlife species, right? It's to control the conflict between fleas and cats, because that conflict inadvertently affects a lot of people as well. And so I just think it's so interesting how we'll take, like, cats don't have a problem with them. Like, if you've ever met a cat that has fleas, like, they're good. They'll do a little itch here, a little lick there, but they're not, like, fazed. They're not bothered. Their day isn't ruined by fleas, right? So it's very much, right, this control of flea populations is very much for human benefit, I find. So I think it's very interesting how whenever we add the sort of human perspective or human element to these wildlife conflicts, we can make the situation not only worse, but deadly. Like, that just gags me. It's also interesting, too, because it's not like these chemicals exist within a vacuum, or once you take them off your pet, like, they're just, that's it, that's end all and be all, right? And there's actually been a couple studies done that have linked the neonicotinoids, right, in these collars to entire bee die-offs, right? Entire populations of bees that have just died off. And so as a result, we now have, like, there are some states in the United States and some parts of Canada that have, like, okay, we're going to restrict this. But generally speaking, neonicotinoids are, like, good to go. You can put them in whatever plastic and put them on whatever pet and call it a day. And I think the gag is the most, that these products are still being sold, right? That the Environmental Protection Agency has actually done nothing to alert the public that there may even be an issue, right, with this sort of combination of chemicals in these collars. And it just, in my opinion, it really just goes to show that under capitalism, there is no evil you can't imagine or create. And that, I'm going to leave it there because it's getting a little too heavy and I'm getting a little too heated just thinking about this conflict anymore. So, yeah. Apologies for... I'm not sorry, actually. I take it back. I'm not sorry for this amazingly long episode. Enjoy. Get your life. Get your cookies. Chomp, chomp, chomp. Eat it up. Because it is what? Delicious. Yes. And just expect... a little bit of a game change. Actually, there's literally not going to be any game change. It's just going to be the changes that I mentioned up at the top of the episode, as well as I'm going to try and do my best moving forward to be just a little bit more direct, a little bit more to the point, especially when it comes to introducing topics and just sort of starting out a segment, because I know I can be a little bit rambly. But love y'all, and thanks for just putting up with me and season one as we got through this messy, essy situationship, this entanglement, if you will. Shout out Jada, Red Table Talk. But we're moving, we're expanding, we're growing. And season two is here. It's going to be queerer, okay? And it's going to be even more steeped in community. Okay, enough rambling. I'll catch y'all next week. Bye.